intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Welcome to the brightest audience in the country. This is Real Science Radio. I'm Fred Williams.
And I'm Doug McBurney, and I'm honored to be sitting in with you, Fred, for Real Science Radio as we tackle part three of the dual slit revelation show. I'm not sure what we call it. That's what I'm going
to
call it.
That'll work. Yeah, so we promised we'd get to this. We mentioned it last week. So I'd like to start the show with this audio clip from this famous physicist who's on YouTube.
Yes, this is from the Royal Institute. This is Jim Al-Khalili, right?
Yep.
We've got about 10 seconds from the Royal Institute.
Now, if you can explain this using common sense and logic, do let me know, because there's a Nobel Prize for you.
So I just want to be clear that when he asks, if you can explain this using common sense and logic, he's asking for the why. Why would this be? Because quantum physics professors have identified fairly accurately, we think, the how?
Yeah, for the most part.
Or what's happening anyway.
Yeah.
They've described what's happening, but why? Why would it be this way?
Yeah. And so right now, and we mentioned this last week, in heaven, you know, I think Sir Isaac Newton is giving Bob Inyart the Nobel Prize for discovering the why. Now, you know, everybody in heaven already knew the why.
Right.
But Bob figured it out before he left.
That's right.
I had mentioned last week in a text to Bob that I thought it was the greatest discovery he's made. The most eye-opening for me on 15 years of doing the show.
Wow.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is we're going to review the last couple of shows. We're going to, you know, review this whole double slit quantum mechanics thing and try to put it in abstract terms, as Bob always tried to do, to make it, you know, we're the listening audience. You don't have to get out your calculator to figure out and follow along the show. And then Bob mentioned in the last show in part two that he had some ideas on how to run experiments for this.
Right.
And then we had one objection come in from a listener, and we're going to deal with that. And then finally, Bob had a really interesting prediction that was tied to this whole dual particle, this whole duality of waves and particles, and tie it with photosynthesis, which
right.
is really super interesting. The people that are friends with Bob, we all got together, and we believe we figured out what his experiments and predictions were, and we'll do the best we can to communicate those to the audience. If we get them wrong, you know, that'll be a fun topic with Bob, among many other
right.
things, when we see him again.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
Okay. So, you know, one of the things is Bob, you know, he taught me to think of the universe in terms of information. You know, I'm an information guy. It's part of my job as a software engineer. But I was always kind of lazy with quantum mechanics because it was always kind of fuzzy to me and I didn't really dig into it. And Bob was really fascinated by it for many years, actually. And he really got me to start looking at it. And when you do from an abstract sense, you can really kind of see what's going on. You don't have to be rocket scientists, so don't be intimidated by this. We're not going to get into any of these fancy long equations with a lot of Greek letters.
Okay, good.
We're just going to really just kind of look at the big picture. So, you know, I wanted to first talk about information and then how it plays into the two-slit experiment. And we could, you know, I would recommend the audience go review one of my personal favorite shows, and it was Quantum Mechanics, Wave Particle Duality is a Triality. And I had told Bob in a text, you really need to get that and this whole dual slit thing that he revealed here in August into a paper. And I, you know, I have a dream that somehow maybe I can help do that, and it needs to be published.
Wow.
You can see that at rsr.org/quantum. So, Doug, you know, from this article, there's a part that Bob wrote that I highlighted that I thought maybe we'd go through to help convey this whole important concept of how information plays into everything. You know, the famous John Wheeler, the physicist, he had broken his career into three major pieces. It was first particles, then fields. Then he said everything is information.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of from the Bible, when it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So the emphasis on Word. All things were made through him, and without him, the Word, nothing was made that was made. So again, there's a part from that article, Doug, that I think's worth going through.
Okay.
That Bob wrote.
And I can quote it directly from the article. By the way, what a beautiful piece of literature that is. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Just
yeah, the
amazing.
Literature. Yeah, good point.
The author of the Bible, just amazing beauty in how it was crafted. And now I'll quote Bob Enyart appropriately enough.
Yeah.
Rather than a wave-particle duality, perhaps a more complete and leading to a more scientific understanding is the description of matter as a wave-particle-word triality. And perhaps, as with vegetation, animals, and people, the non-physical aspect of matter is, ironically, the greater substance. Plants have a body, animals have a body and a soul, and human beings have a body, soul, and spirit, which happens also to be the domain of information.
Yes.
Information. Information is the greatest substance. And Bob includes the scripture references to back that up. This is not just an opinion piece. And then Bob continues, yet the non-physical realm, which happens also to be the domain of information, is the greatest substance for all three, for plants, animals, and people.
So we've got matter, energy, and information. So that's the triality.
Right. Matter, energy, and information. If normal metabolism happened to replace every atom in a favorite pet's body, as long as it had breath, it would still have its identity. That is, its soul would persist. For animals too, then, and even aside from their immaterial biological information, the physical component is not the greater substance. For human beings, and known through general and special revelation that, as above, our spirits survive even cremation. Our physical body is not remotely the greater substance of our existence.
Yeah. So, you know, some people will, they don't want to be cremated because they somehow think that just ends them, you know.
That's right.
They have some superstitious belief. But what a great point by Bob. You know, it's not the physical component that's the bigger substance. It's the information that's part of this triality. And in that article, you know, we went through all the different examples of triality in the Bible. And again, you can see that at rsr.org/quantum.
Mm-hmm. And Bob continues, and the genetic molecule is not the deepest substance of broccoli. For just as with ink in a book, even with plants, amino acids are not the essence. And in some respects, clearly a human being is an epistle. A letter written not with ink, but by the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of flesh.
Yeah, so you were quoting 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 3.
That's right.
An epistle written not with ink, but the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of flesh. How cool is that?
Mm-hmm.
And again, what a great, great, great show that was on the wave-particle duality is a triality. What a great insight by Dr. Bob Enyart, as far as I'm concerned. He's getting his PhD, right? His honorable PhD from Sir Isaac Newton right now.
That's right. I love it.
So we're going to review again what Bob's discovery was with the why behind the dual slit experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, again, maybe quickly we'd go through what information is, again, so that everybody kind of has a big picture. So, Doug, you know, a robot, just imagine you see a robot and it's sitting there and it plays a piano.
Yeah.
So, you know, the robot has, you know, metal pieces and parts, and it's got a battery. So can just metal and battery make a robot play the piano? There's probably something missing there.
Right. The robot would need some instructions delivered via information that would enable the robot to play a song on the piano.
Exactly. So there's a component of information that is not physical. It has no mass. You can't weigh it. And that's that third piece that's so critical. You know, years ago, before I worked in the storage industry, I worked for a traffic light company. So we designed the traffic light controllers. So if you think of a traffic light, it's a pole. You know, it's got metal, it's got lights, it's got a control box, and it's got power to drive it. If it's just the materials and matter, when you plug it in, it won't do anything useful except, you know, maybe cause accidents. You know, apparently they had some really bad information in some units in Puerto Rico, and you'd have green both ways, but that's another story. Man. Yeah. So you then install a program into the control box so that the light maybe randomly cycles between green, yellow, and red, but at least it logically assures the opposite direction lights are doing, you know, doing something don't conflict.
Okay.
So now, Doug, imagine you're traveling down a busy highway and you come across an intersection that the other direction it's lightly traveled.
Okay.
So, and you've noticed day in, day out that the traffic light turns red half the time for you and half the time for the slow intersection. Is that, how do you feel about that?
It would seem like the more heavily traveled road would need more green lights. That's what I would want.
And that's exactly right. I mean, you'd get annoyed and you'd think that light, traffic light is stupid, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, in fact, I called the traffic director in Lafayette on my drive to Micron.
Oh, yeah?
And I actually complained. I said, you know, that light at Diamond Circle is really stupid because it's on way too long. It backs up traffic, you know, into the other intersection. I think it's Arapahoe Road. And he, you know, it's the second time I've done that in my life where I called a traffic controller because I was annoyed. And he was, both times, they were both very receptive. You know, he goes, yeah, thanks for that. And, you know, it's actually CDOT that controls that. But I'm going to contact him because we don't need that pollution in Lafayette because, you know, that's just going to cause traffic to back up.
Sure.
It took him about 3 to 6 months. You know, it's a bureaucracy. But they actually did fix that light. And I told people driving to work, you can thank me for that. I called and complained.
Way to go, Fred. Way to
go. So part of a traffic light system is you know, what you do is you install a coil, a wire beneath the street. So if you ever see those lines that you can kind of make out, when a car drives over it, it changes the magnetic inductance.
So then you can
tie that into the traffic controller and that becomes a signal, you know, that says, okay, there's a car here. But that's still not enough to do anything. You know, as a programmer for that traffic light, we have to act on that and we actually have to look at it becomes information. There's a code that says, okay, this thing's here. Now we got to do additional code to say, okay, how long are we going to allow this, you know, light to stay, say, red in the direction of the lightly traveled traffic? Yeah. Maybe normally you do like 20, 30 seconds after a car drives on it, and then you give them 5 to 10 seconds to clear out of there. So I'm just trying to convey what information is, and then I'm going to give you a really crude analogy towards how light behaves as a wave in a particle.
Okay.
Imagine the traffic light is green in one direction forever and only switches to something else when information tells it to. In fact, it kind of reminds me, I was driving home one time late at night in Arvada. This is years ago. I was, before I even met Bob, I was a carnal Christian. I played in a rock band. And it was 2 a.m. and I was driving and there's a light that was red and it was a slow intersection. So I ran the red light.
Right.
But way in the distance, there was a cop. And I thought, I'm like, okay, I'm taking my chances, but he pulls me over and he gives me the, you know, you shouldn't have run that. And I told him back and I was very respectful. I said, officer, I guarantee you I will do this again because the odds are I won't get caught again for 5 years. It's worth it to me, you know, because this light doesn't need to be red right here. I'm the only one here. So kind of a crude analogy is if you think of whenever something crosses over that sensor for the light, it's like that became information.
Right.
In a very crude way, maybe it's like the wave, me driving down the road, collapsed into a particle, like a collapse in the particle in the form of a ticket. So I'm just trying to get across to the audience that there's this extra element of information. You can't weigh it. It's not physical. And it's super critical to understanding life, you know, the duality is a triality. There's so many threes in the Bible, just so many references to the importance of information. So this gets us to the why. We're going to review the why again. We've covered it the last two shows. So the why behind the dual slit experiment, and maybe we should talk about the dual slit experiment real quickly again. About what's going on there, how light is both a wave and a particle?
Yes.
Okay.
So if you have a box that emits photons in a specific direction, and you put a wall in front of it, and you cut two slits in the wall, and then you put another wall behind that wall, and you start firing photons at the first wall, photons will go through the slits and strike the wall in the back, right?
Yep.
And you would expect, since a photon is a particle, that it would just create two strips of impact lines on that back wall.
Yeah, like the number 11 in a sense, if you can
picture that. Sure, yeah. It's, think about like shooting tennis balls at these two slits.
Yeah.
Where the tennis balls impacted, eventually you would get these two lines.
Yeah, like you got baby powder on the tennis balls, and so they hit the wall and they leave their mark.
Exactly. So that's what we would expect to see. But in fact, what we see is the particles pass through the two slits, but instead of creating two definable lines on the back wall, they create a pattern of lines, what scientists refer to as an interference pattern. So this pattern that develops on the back wall indicates to the scientists that these particles are actually passing through that first wall then with the two slits as a wave.
Yeah,
and the waves are interfering with each other on the other side as they strike that back wall.
Yeah, and the way they interfere, the peaks of each of the waves, so they become two waves when they go through the slits, and then they interfere with each other, and then the peaks interact, and the peaks are the ones where you get the lines on the board. Then the destructive interference, you don't have the lines. Kind of imagine like, I don't know, a bathtub or something that has two slits at the end that goes into another bathtub, and you drop a pebble in it. That water is going to go as a wave, and then when it hits those two holes or slits, there'll be two more waves coming out in the other bathtub that's going to interfere with each other.
Right.
And so they didn't expect that. You know, they thought, you know, they expected particles. They'd see the 11 pattern, but instead they're getting interference. It's like, ah, light is a wave. And then eventually, then Einstein realized, they're actually a particle too.
And so even if they got down to just shooting one photon at a time through the slit, they were still seeing this interference pattern. And so the scientists wanted to observe it and see which slit is this particle going through.
So they added a detector at either slit.
Right.
Yep.
And once they started observing it, the photon started to behave again according to what we would expect from the normal laws of physics. And you got the 11 pattern.
You got the 11 patterns back.
Right.
So that showed that light was both a wave and a particle. Mm-hmm. So basically when you observe the light, which is a wave when it's coming, when you observe it, it becomes a particle.
That's what that appears is, to be happening. Yeah. And if you can explain this using common sense and knowledge, there's a Nobel Prize for you.
Well, so what Bob came up with, which is just so ingenious, was that God used quantum physics so that Adam and Eve can see distant stars. You know, the stars that were created on day four, when Adam and Eve were created, they could see distant starlight. And it makes really a lot of sense if you think of stars, and even the more distant stars, they've got these photons heading towards Earth, and as that wave, it's coming as a wave.
Yeah.
Really, almost, it's kind of like an equation's heading your way. It's a, it's a wave is a like a wave functions like a probability density equation. And then when you observe it, it collapses it into a particle. It actually turns something that really isn't material yet. It's totally immaterial. It becomes material. It becomes a particle. And when it hits your retina on your eye. And so, you know, that explains why we can see these distant stars. It's remarkable. And so, you know, the heavens declare the glory of God.
Amen.
So God wanted us to be able to see distant starlight. And what an incredible revelation that Bob had realized.
Right.
Tell me someone else who's thought of this. I've never heard this. And when he said it, it was like a light went off. You know, sorry for the, you know, pun probably intended. You know.
Well, and let me just explain, because there's people in the audience like me who have a hard time even. So researchers and scientists and people into quantum physics generally agree on what's happening here, that this particle is expressed initially as a wave, as just a potentiality for there to be a particle somewhere, and once it's observed, it becomes a particle.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. Why? Because God wanted Adam and Eve and their children to be able to see the distant stars that he put in the sky, Because as Bob said, God had impressed himself with the whole creation of the universe. Yeah. He thought it was amazing. Yeah. And he wanted his children to be able to see it, see these distant stars. And the only way that the creator could make that happen so that everybody could be looking up in the sky and everybody could see the stars that God wanted us to see, the only way he could make it happen, he had to make it this way. That's why.
Yeah, it's so cool. And you know, in this remembrance group that we've, a lot of us have been sharing stories, remembering about Bob, his son Dom Inyard asked the question, which do you think were Bob's favorite verses? And the one that came up to me, immediately came to mind for me, was Psalm 19:1, which is, mm-hmm. The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. We've talked about information. They pour forth speech. Night after night they display knowledge, you know, which you could tie to information. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard. So there's no one that, you know, this is for his creation to enjoy the beautiful night sky. There's this physicist, his name's Andre Lind of Stanford University. He said, the universe and the observer exist as a pair. I cannot imagine a consistent theory of the universe that ignores consciousness.
Hmm.
You know, and it's too bad the guy's probably an atheist, but maybe not, you know. But wow. So the next part we were going to talk about, we finally got to it. So let's talk about the experiments that Bob had proposed. And again, we had to, you know, cobble together different information from people that Bob had talked to before he passed.
Yes.
But I think we got a pretty good idea of what he was thinking. Now, one of his ideas was that, you know, NASA commissioned a whole bunch of people to look at a star, you know, the same faint star, just get a ton of people to look at it.
Right.
So there's a quantized slice of time where each, when each proton wave arrives, this probability density. And then, so there should be an experiment where many observers observing this specific dense star in a specific slice of time, it should be dim to other observers.
Mm.
So he proposed another experiment. So that one, yeah, okay. I get that one, but
It'd be hard to measure that.
So when I was talking with his son, Dom, we thought there was another one that was a little bit better, and that's this. So on a clear evening, you could use, say, 10 cameras and put them very, very close together and then measure the number of photons captured in this in a specific slice of time from a specific distant star. Now, we're using a distant star because it'll have, you know, there will be fewer photons arriving. This photon wave will be, you know, it'll be enormous because it's a distant star. Because as it gets to us, that probability density, there should be fewer photons that can land on our retina.
Right.
So using this, then we would measure how many photons these 10 cameras measured. Then repeat that experiment on another clear night, but this time use 100 cameras close together. And then count the number of photons that they're capturing. Because realize, as a camera captures a photon, it's stealing it from another camera. You know,
that's
he wins. I got it. Ha ha. I get this photon. So then the experiment should show that if you look at the camera one in that first group of 10 the day before when we did the experiment, it should have a proportionally larger number of photons in its camera than the first camera in the group of 100 that we did the next night.
Yes, I get it. It's difficult, but I get
it's just the photon counter. So accountants out there, you should definitely get this, right?
Now, we know that Bob's initial experiment proposal included people. He wanted people to all look. And we know that atheist physicists tend to not want consciousness to be a part of the mix. And so that kind of helped us, I think, lead us to the idea of maybe just using receptors, cameras, not people. And
good point.
Because many things can absorb photons, like human eyes, cameras, even plants.
Yeah, you mentioned plants and photosynthesis. I think this might actually be a good dovetail into the predictions that Bob mentioned, and then we'll get to the one objection. But I think it's going to be really cool to talk about a prediction he made that makes a ton of sense, and it has to do with photosynthesis. And this is where, you know, plants take, you know, it takes light from the sun, it converts it into sugar, and it feeds a plant, and the plant's going to put off oxygen. And then at night, photosynthesis completely shuts down. And during the evening, then the plant kind of rests. They call it respiration.
Right.
But here's what's interesting that Bob had predicted, that, okay, so in this process where photosynthesis shuts down completely, that plant is no longer capturing photons, whether it be from the sun or let's say it's nighttime and it's capturing them from the stars.
Right.
If they were actually capturing photons, if photosynthesis didn't shut down, then the stars would be a little dimmer, especially the distant ones, because those plants are, they're stealing our ability to see the distant stars, because they're that piece of matter that's become a receptor, in a sense, that's grabbing those photons. So Bob's prediction was that there would be a way to determine that photosynthesis, if we could look at, say, when it happens, when the photosynthesis turns off, that the distant stars become a little bit more visible.
Mm. Okay, that makes sense. It sounded to me, remember, folks, we were gathering this information from numerous sources, all who received a little bit of it here and a little bit of it there. So maybe instead of saying the prediction may have been that there was a way to measure that the distant stars become a little more visible when photosynthesis shuts down at night, maybe Bob was thinking that at some point in the future, it may actually be measured and it might be shown that when photosynthesis shuts down at night, that the distant stars become just a little bit brighter.
Yeah. So a correlation between photosynthesis and these more distant stars becoming a little bit more bright.
Right.
And that would honor God, you know.
Well, that would be evidence in support of Bob's theory of the why.
Exactly.
Why? Yes.
Yeah, scientists may not, you know, they'd probably be okay with, okay, yeah, there's a correlation.
Yes.
But they wouldn't agree with the why, but it defends our position on the why.
Right. And of course, it doesn't really matter what the atheist physicists do with the prediction or how they respond. What really matters is just the prediction. It's out there. It may be right. It may be wrong.
And what did Bob say about predictions?
Predictions are the hard currency of science.
That's right. We'll have to add it to our predictions page.
There you go. And that reminds me that we need to remain focused on the why. The object of the prediction is to support the why. Why did God make light behave the way it does? It was because he wanted all of his creation, all the people, the potential people, not just Adam and Eve, but all the potential people on Earth, to be able to see even the distant stars. So that's Real Science Radio for this week. Thank you, Fred, for being here. I want to thank Rich Huxford in the background for helping with the show. Tune in next week, where we'll talk all about information and matter and energy and the dual slit and predictions and objections. For Real Science Radio and Fred Williams, I'm Doug McBurney. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.